From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Sunday night's presidential debate between Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders was seen as a critical chance for Sanders to make his case as he lags more than 100 delegates behind the former vice president in a race that has now been upended by the coronavirus. It was the first time the two candidates faced off against just one another. The debate came 2 days before the next set of primary races. My guest is Doug Henwood, a political economist, editor of Left Business Observer, author of After the New Economy, and My Turn, Hillary Clinton Targets the Presidency. He's also the host of a radio show on Pacifica called Behind the News. Welcome to the program, Doug.
Thanks for having me.
So, of course, it was not at all surprising that the debate focused on the coronavirus. It is the big issue. Before we even get to what it was that the two candidates said that they would do if they were president in this particular disaster, as an economist, how seriously has this crisis exposed the pitfalls of our dismantled state of our deregulated economy?
Oh, it's very serious. I mean, as I said on the social media, this crisis really reveals problems at the heart of the whole American model. The lack of social protection is a really cruel joke of a healthcare system. The polarization, instability, the collapse of state capability, and also the consciousness of competitive individualism, which is what dominates the way people think and view the world. You know, the toilet paper hoarding, which I guess it's been seen around the world, but it just seems like everybody going for their own little piece of the action rather than trying to cooperate to get our way through this crisis. And of course, the special case of the healthcare system, which is a uniquely American disaster. It just reveals so much that's wrong with this model. And then, you know, we're all vulnerable to a very, very serious recession because of the erosion of the public sector, irresponsible levels of indebtedness among private corporations, and I think the absolute dependence on high levels of spending on everything. I mean, it's just it really is, you know, aside from the health effects, it really does reveal so much about what's wrong with the society.
One of the things that didn't come up on Sunday night's debate was the fact that the legislative package agreed to by Democrats and Republicans on Friday had a gaping loophole. A package that was supposed to provide paid sick leave to most American workers ended up providing paid sick leave to almost no American workers. Only about 20% of the workforce would be guaranteed paid sick leave because the bill exempts corporations with more than 500 employees. This didn't come up, but this too, even in the crisis moment, it seems that we're protecting corporations.
Yeah, and the big guys, you know, there's this myth around that that small business is the driver of job growth in the country, and that's not really true. Actually, small businesses had a somewhat mildly declining share of employment over the last couple of decades, and big businesses had a somewhat increasing share of employment. So this is not a nation of small businesses. And, you know, this becomes obvious in this ridiculous loophole they wrote into the law. Why can't large firms afford to pay people, you know, 2 weeks of sick leaves? The rest of the world does it. It's not a problem.
Arguably, they are more capable of providing paid sick leave than small businesses, right?
Right. They've got the money. They've got plenty of money. And I guess they're going to have some public subsidies for the smaller businesses.
Sure.
But, you know, big business can pay it. It's got, corporations have been rolling in profits since 2009. They recovered very rapidly from the Great Recession, much more so than the working class did. And they've been just rolling in money. And what they've been spending on for the last 5 or 7 years is not investment, not expansion, not R&D, but buying up each other and buying back shares of their own stock to boost its price. They've been spent $5 or $6 trillion over the last decade just buying their own shares to boost the price, which is good for executives, good for shareholders, but a tremendous waste of money. And we're going into this crisis with a capital structure, the private capital structure, and the public it's just been eroded and depreciated, and we're really in trouble.
So let's talk about Sunday night's debate specifically. Obviously, the issue of Medicare for All came up. This is a crisis that has so deeply exposed the pitfalls of our current healthcare system, or really a lack of our healthcare system, that it was made for a Bernie Sanders presidency. He tried to make the case that in addition to the short-term effort of making sure that coronavirus testing and treatment would be free, that we needed a Medicare for All system in the long term. Biden shot back saying this has nothing to do with Medicare for All. He even went as far as saying, look at Italy, it has a single payer system, it didn't work. What do you make of this exchange between the two candidates about over a Medicare for All system?
Well, you know, I think Sanders could have made the points better. I mean, he really didn't, I think, explicitly make the point well enough that we have a short-term problem and a long-term problem. He tried to, but I don't think he made it pointedly enough. That the short-term problem, yes, you know, we need free testing, we need free treatment for all the coronavirus sickness that comes down. But you know, what led us to this problem and our inability to respond to it has been decades of policy. We've had decades-long policy of reducing the number of hospital beds. So we have the fewest numbers of hospital beds relative to our population of any of the rich countries in the world. And this has been deliberate policy. It's not an accident. So that kind of policy, which has been driven by the interests of private hospital chains and insurance companies, you know, has just left us with unable to respond in a decent way to this crisis. And then longer term, there going to be sequels. You know, people are going to have ongoing problems resulting from this. They're going to have ancillary problems. Sanders did make a good example out of saying, good point saying that people who aren't sick themselves, but maybe their spouse is sick, are going to suffer psychological problems that wouldn't be treated, that under a Medicare for All system they would be treated. So yeah, we have a long-term problem and a short-term problem. Medicare for All addresses the long-term problem, but I don't even know if we're capable of addressing the short-term problem. We had Trump on Monday morning. Trump told the governors, get your own ventilators. I mean, what kind of leadership is that he tells them, get your own damn ventilators? It's and then he segues from that to saying, we inherited a broken system. We're going to make it the talk of the world. He just makes up nonsense. And he's the leader we deserve in many ways. I mean, he's the kind of person that a rotting social system would produce as leader. But now we have to suffer the consequences of that. And he's only making it all worse.
And in fact, Sanders, I thought, quite effectively and straightforwardly said that the first thing we've got to do is to shut this president up right now because he's undermining the doctors and the scientists who are trying to help American people. He said it's unacceptable for him to be blabbering with unfactual information, which is confusing the general public. I thought that was a strong position to take at the outset, perhaps Sanders's best moment of the debate.
Yeah, it was nice. But I think he was inhibited. I got this feeling in 2016 when he was campaigning against Hillary that he didn't want to say anything that was too harsh that could be used in a Trump ad against his opponent, whether it's then Hillary, now Biden. And I got the feeling he's pulling his punches. He doesn't want to damage him too much because I think in the back of his mind, he's pretty resigned to knowing that he's not going to be the nominee and that Biden will be. And is so focused on beating Trump that he doesn't want to do too much damage to the likely candidate.
Let's talk about their the tussle over what Biden has said or not said on Social Security that made for perhaps the most caustic part of the debate. Biden took umbrage of the fact that Sanders has been running ads saying that he's opposed to Social Security. Those ads feature video of Biden saying the things that he said. They aren't doctored videos. And so I thought this was really interesting because Sanders reminded him that time and time you've talked about with pride the necessity of cutting Social Security, cutting Medicare. You've repeatedly talked about how you would do it over and over and over again. And Biden just refused to accept even that maybe he did say that and his position has evolved. He attempted to rewrite the past. What did you make of this exchange?
That was stunning because, you know, he did say multiple times in the 80s and 90s that we have to go after the entitlements. And, you know, even Obama himself, in March or April of 2009, shortly after taking office, in the midst of the financial crisis, Obama or somebody very close to him got called up David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, and said, we need to go after entitlements after we get through this problem. So, you know, that was official Obama administration policy. There was the Bowles-Simpson panel, which was supposed to come up with some grand bargain that was going to cut Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security. Fortunately, it failed. But this has been mainstream centrist Democrat position for 20 or 30 years. Bill Clinton, of course, wanted to flirt with privatizing Social Security, and only Monica Lewinsky saved us from that. So, you know, it's remarkable how they're trying to escape that history. I suppose it's a good thing that he feels he has to lie about it now, that that kind of austerity politics will not sell. And it was fascinating to watch Biden kind of bend towards the way that the Sanders campaign and Sanders, and then the movement has grown up around him, has really transformed the nature of political discourse in the country. He had to pretend to be at least coming from the left or paying the left some homage. So there is that. That's encouraging. But fluency with which Biden lied was just remarkable.
I'm so glad you brought up this issue of where the debate has moved, because watching the debate on Sunday night, it was remarkable that the talking points raised by moderators and the responses by both candidates, not just Sanders, have shifted dramatically. The Wall Street Journal on Monday pointed out Biden's plans, not Sanders, Biden's plans show how party center has shifted left. Many Democratic proposals, write the paper, now described as moderate, are more liberal than those of Clinton or Obama. And many people on social media, as the debate was happening, pointed out that Biden is essentially plagiarizing Sanders' positions on so many issues and acting like this is something he's just come up with himself. I suppose we should see that as a testament to the candidacies of people like Sanders, but also maybe Warren and some of the other candidates who are no longer running.
Yeah, it was also a funny moment when Biden said something like, I'm trying to give you credit and you wouldn't let me. but, you know, that's one of the things we love about Bernie. He's just so obstreperous and will not give an inch. Who can trust him? I mean, given his history, given who funds him, there was a lively moment, too, where Sanders said, you know, your campaign is funded by pharmaceuticals and the hospital industry and, you know, the healthcare industry. And Biden tried to deny that. But of course, that's true. It's just amazing what he tried, all the truth that he tried to deny. But, you know, he's going to say these things now to get elected. And then when he gets into office, I think, you know, the odds are that he's going to win. I used to think that Trump was going to win, but now with this crisis, Trump's obvious botching of it, except in the eyes of his most loyal supporters, and the inevitable recession, which is likely to be harsh and sudden. Now, most recessions unfold over the course of months. This one is practically unfolding overnight, people losing jobs, people losing income in such a shock in such a short period of time. And you know, combine that with the intense health crisis we're going through and the social isolation and the psychological freak out that we're all undergoing right now. I don't think that's going to be very good for Trump's reelection prospects. So it's likely that Biden will win. And then the question is, what kind of administration will he run? Will he just have a bunch of Wall Street people, a Treasury, you know, the same old crew? Or will he, you know, have some nods to what has been coming from the left? We shall see. But it's going to be hard for him to get the votes of young people, although, you know, young people don't necessarily go out to vote very much. So I don't know how important that is. But it's going to be harder to get the votes of the Sanders people if he's going to be so offensive. And his advisor, Anita Dunn, said on Monday morning, characterized, who, by the way, gave pro bono legal advice to Harvey Weinstein. She said, you know, Biden dealt in a civil fashion with somebody who was like a rude demonstrator at one of Biden's rallies. I mean, that's not the way to develop the kind of party unity he needs to win. But they're so arrogant and so full of contempt for the left of the party that it almost seems as if they're willing to sacrifice the election just not to let the left have any power.
To their face, the two of them are a little bit more polite to one another, but in a previous rally before all the rallies were canceled, Biden dismissed protesters who held up signs for the Green New Deal saying, oh, they're just Bernie bros. And this is, of course, a kind of, this is what a lot of supporters of Sanders fear and suspect would happen in a Biden candidacy, that he would say and do whatever it took to get elected, which is paying lip service to the progressive ideals that are now more and more popular. But as president, once in office, that he would move, you know, back to the right. Going back to your point about what sort of administration he would have, there was some discussion of that on Sunday night's debate. Biden, first Sanders said, my administration would look like America. And then Biden repeated that almost word for word, that his administration would also look like America. Biden was asked if he would have a woman as a vice president, and he said he absolutely would. I thought Sanders's position was a little bit better. He said most likely a woman, but it's more important for her to be a progressive woman, because of course there's a vast amount of difference between a Hillary Clinton and, you know, say an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, right?
Yeah, I was a little disappointed that I can understand how Sanders, who is a stubborn fellow and probably felt like he's being trapped into something like that and just didn't want to say yes, but he should have just said yes,
right,
and gotten it over with. I was really disappointed with that, you know, and the hemming and hawing, you know, sort of gave some fuel to some of his feminist critics. And I don't think we really need to do that at this point. But yeah, like, which woman? Is it going to be, you know, somebody out of Goldman Sachs, or is it going to be someone with a good progressive reputation? Knowing what we know about Biden, I think it's more likely to be somebody out of Goldman Sachs, but we'll see.
And so let's also now shift to what's happening nationwide around the economy and the Trump administration. You referred earlier to the fact that we're seeing this very fast-moving recession. And while there is some scorn on the left over the obsession with the stock market and Wall Street, I think it's really important for us to also see that this coronavirus crisis could destroy not just the abstract economy, but of course the very real economy. If you have a small business that's relying on customers coming in person every day and suddenly has to take a 3-month break or even a 2-month or 1-month break, that small business will likely not survive, right? So we're going to see bankruptcies, we're going to see layoffs, we're going to see people unable to have food on the table, we're not going to be able to necessarily have enough food stamps for these folks, enough resources. This is a very, very real economic crisis, right?
Yeah, you know, we 2008-2009 was a financial crisis, originated in the financial sector. Of course, housing is a real thing, but so much of it came around finance. And we've become used to, over the last 20, 30 years, to these sorts of financial crises, periodic financial explosions. There was this the stock market crash in 1987, the savings and loan crisis the late 80s, the Asian crisis, the long-term capital management, all these things that most younger people wouldn't even know about, but I'm old enough to remember all these things. But this is a real sector crisis. It is, it's, you know, the people can't go to work, people can't buy things, and are just physically isolated and scared. And of course, some of this hoarding, I guess, will be a little bit of a stimulus to consumer spending. But, you know, it's the broader problem is going to be very, very real, and it's not. You know, the Federal Reserve can do all it can to try to pump up the financial markets, but that's not where the problem lies. The problem really is in the real sector, and that to address those sorts of problems, we need very aggressive public spending, support for people who are out of work, whose businesses are going under.
And precisely that was not is not on the table so far, it seems, although the Democrats paid some lip service to that in the earlier drafts of their legislation. And it didn't seem to come up very much on Sunday night's debate as well, a massive public spending program.
Right. Direct income support would be very important. Mitt Romney, of all people, said just send everybody a $1,000 check.
He suddenly made the case for universal basic income. Andrew Yang should be thrilled.
Yeah, you know, that's the kind of thing we need. I mean, no, $1,000 wouldn't go very far, but it's certainly a lot better than nothing. But that's the kind of thing we need, that kind of very aggressive public spending. Part of the problem, though, is, you know, we're running $1 trillion deficits in good times.
And speaking of the deficits, Trump wants to do a payroll cut. That's not going to help, right? Because he thinks putting money into people's pockets via a payroll cut is better. Why is that a bad thing?
Well, you know, I think nobody seems to want it, so it's not an idea that's going to go anywhere. But I think the danger is that they use this payroll tax cut as a way of undermining Social Security for the long term. That makes me very nervous. But something along those lines needs to be done. And also just, you know, our physical infrastructure, the health infrastructure, but also, you know, transportation, buildings, everything in this country is falling to pieces. We have, you know, millionaires with their nice big mansions and their McMansions are just doing fine, but the public infrastructure is a disaster. And that's the kind of thing we need to be spending money on. But no, the tax cuts, $1 trillion deficits just to fund tax cuts for rich people. It's just a profligacy on a criminal scale. A pointless profligacy. We've got nothing for it. I mean, it's not even that the rich people are doing good works with their money and building art museums. They're just like, you know, indulging in luxury consumption and private jets and building their own bunkers when the inevitable day of reckoning comes. So it's just this society is in a real crisis, and this is just coming to a head because of this virus.
The fact that that Joe Biden on Sunday got defensive when accused of taking money from billionaires seems to be a good sign. Don't you think, Doug, that even though we didn't really hear much about some sort of public spending, the ultra wealthy in this country are successfully increasingly being identified as the central problem, the fact that they are sucking up so much wealth. I mean, we talk about toilet paper hoarding. What about all the handful of people who are hoarding all the wealth in this country?
It's just remarkable. It's grotesque on a scale we haven't seen in a century. You know, you have to go back to the 1929 stock market crash really defined to this level of wealth and income inequality. I think enough people now are so angry the callousness of our ruling class, the callousness and incompetence of our ruling class is just, it's just obvious to anybody who's paying any attention. Now, of course, you have these Yahoo Trump supporters are going to Chili's restaurants and like yucking it up because they don't believe this crisis is for real. But that's what, you know, maybe 30% of the population. I think an awful lot of people are saying there's something seriously wrong here. And this plutocracy is really at the core of the problem.
So finally, Doug, do you think Sunday night's debate changed the needle at all? We have primaries coming up on Tuesday. And by the way, as you and I are talking, Ohio just announced that it will be postponing its primary till June, which means now Arizona, Florida, and Illinois are the three that will be voting so far on Tuesday. Do you think that this debate moved the needle at all?
Well, not very much, I don't think. And Biden, I guess, since he didn't obviously drool or lapse into surrealistic fantasies, I guess he's, you know, he came through pretty well.
Right. But, all he had to do was not screw up.
Right. Yeah. It's not like Gerald Ford in 1976 when he said that Poland wasn't under Soviet domination and that doomed his candidacy. You know, it's quite possible that Biden, who has a history of saying ridiculous things, could have said something ridiculous, but he didn't. And I have to admit, you know, people have been talking about calling his mental competence into question. You know, that his performance was an argument against that. He did fairly well. He looked younger and more vital than he has in some time. So, you know, I guess that barring some kind of weird divine intervention, I guess the nomination is his. The question is, can he be Trump? Trump is a masterful psychological warrior, psychological terrorist, I should say. And he could get under Biden's skin. But you know, the odds are looking bad for Trump right now, given the current economic and health crisis. You know, the Democratic nomination, it does look like Biden's for the having.
Doug, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. You, of course, never know what will happen in these times of crisis, but I might probably agree with what you just said. Thanks so much, as always, for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Bye.
My guest has been Doug Henwood, political economist, editor of Left Business Observer, author of After the New Economy, and My Turn, Hillary Clinton Targets the Presidency, also host of a weekly radio show in Pacifica called Behind the News. We've been discussing Sunday's Democratic debate and how it relates to the ongoing coronavirus crisis. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.